From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We are now just 25 days to Election Day, and throughout this campaign season, we've been sitting down with candidates who will be on the ballot next month. It's a chance to explore their views at length. When possible, we bring candidates together on the same show to discuss where they agree and where they differ on prominent issues. A great opportunity for listeners to do a little comparing of the candidates. And this hour, we can do that, a chance to discuss the issues at stake when voters choose members of Rochester City Council. The East District has two candidates on the ballot next month. Mary Lupien is a Democrat running for Rochester City Council, and we talked to her this past spring into the summer when she was running in the primary against four other Democrats and won easily. So she is on the ballot as a Democrat. Mary, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
And also with us is Dave Sutliff-Adius, who's a Green Party candidate for Rochester City Council, who we've talked to in the past a number of times. Nice to have you back here, Dave. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on again.
So I'm going to open with some opening thoughts from both of you as to what you think are the most prominent issues and the ones animating your campaign. And Mary, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I ran on in the Democratic primary and what I continue to run on is that to have more accessible, safe, and quality affordable housing, to improve our transportation options in the city of Rochester, and to fight for a police accountability board. And underneath all of those issues really is our pervasive and extreme systemic racism that really fuels the poverty in Rochester.
Has anything in this campaign changed your views or sort of updated your thoughts on these, or do you feel even stronger about these issues as you've gone on?
Absolutely. You know, every time I speak to someone who's really experienced issues, it just deepens my understanding of how much in crisis we are in Rochester with our housing, you know, really not much affordable anymore for people who are, you know, having to spend 78% of their income on housing. And, you know, just every day, you know, working in the school, I work in the city schools and hearing students and their perceptions of police in our community, and just the real desperate need we have for accountability and to make sure that we're improving police and community relations for the safety of both sides.
Okay. Dave, issues that animate you. Go ahead.
Well, I do agree that most of our issues are rooted in racism, but I think as someone who would be in office, there's not a lot you can do to change people's hearts and minds. If someone really has a certain outlook, a change in that outlook is not going to come from a politician. But I do think that the overwhelming pervasive issue in Rochester is the systemic poverty that's been going on for generations. And pretty much everything that I'm trying to do with my campaign and when I get into office is going to be centered around that.
All right. And what have you heard when you interact with voters about what animates them?
They are very, very excited about my emphasis on stopping corporate welfare and using those tax dollars that we spend, they give away to build more apartments downtown and development like that, to use for stuff that we really need, like having libraries open and rec centers open 7 days a week and paying our fire department, fully funding them and things like that. That's really been exciting voters I've been talking to.
So as we talk this hour about issues facing Rochester, I suspect the candidates here will agree on a lot, I would guess. We'll find out if that's not true. And Dave, I want to ask you something about just what you choose to do as a candidate for the Green Party.
Okay.
Because when Alex White was on this program last week,
yeah,
we had a listener say at the end of the program, he thought that Alex sounded like he was extremely competent and well-versed on the issues and wondered why not run as a Democrat. And I know that comes up a lot when people are in the Green Party or Libertarians.
Sure.
Why don't you run as something else?
Right.
I think that obviously conflates being a Green with being a Democrat. And I know that those things aren't perfect circles. But have you ever thought about that? Have you thought, you know, if I want to historically gain more traction, do I run as a Democrat?
No. Well, okay, so part of my goal not only is to get in office, but because I see our issues as being systemic. And I think some of those systemic problems come from the way we do business, but as a government, the way our at City Hall or the county building or whatever. So to continue to try to change it from within, I know a lot of really committed activists who have been green, who have said that they were tired of never winning and they're going to go change things from the inside, and politically they're never heard from again. So I am more than willing to fight this fight now so that maybe my daughter someday might want to run for office as a green, and that would be more viable. But I'll be honest with you, Evan, we're at a point right now, and from my door to door and all the voters I've been talking to, I'm hoping, I have a really good feeling that you may be in for a surprise this November.
Okay. Now, and let me also be clear when I ask that. I do not believe, as a journalist or a talk show host, in discounting anybody based on a party line.
No, I understand that, but it's been 40-plus years since a non-Democrat has been in office in the city. I get that.
The premise is not the question is not, well, you can run, but you can't win, because I don't discount anybody's chances of winning just based on the party line. I think that's destructive or unfair. But I do think historically it is interesting to ask, and I want to also ask, are you insulted by that question? Why don't you run as a Democrat?
Not anymore.
Well, it's interesting because you say that a number of Greens have decided to try. You claim that they're never heard from again politically. Who are these people?
No. I'm not doing that. They want to come out and say that's fine.
Could I just add that I used to be a Green?
You did.
And I switched for Bernie to become a Democrat to run.
But you also never got involved in the Green Party when you were a Green. So that's fine, and that's okay.
Would that have hurt my chances?
I don't know. That was your decision to make. I'm not coming. But you're saying how I used to be Green. I wasn't even going
to
bring
that up.
No,
I'm just saying, to say that they're never heard from politically again, I think maybe sets the tone that it's not a good decision to make. That
You would be the first if you win.
Okay.
You would be the first.
So I'll ask you then.
Sure.
Why did you switch from Green to Democrat? And you consider yourself a Green still?
So to answer the first part of the question, I switched to become a Democrat to vote for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary in 2016. I changed parties based on the candidate. And, you know, Bernie Sanders is still an independent. He just got permission to run on the Democratic line. I think that in order to win, you have to join the dominant party. And personally, I would love to see a multi-party system, but there are some real barriers in the way preventing that from happening. If we had proportionate representation so that, you know, if a Green got 11%, you know, they would get 11% of the representation like they do in other countries, and if we had ranked choice voting. But without those two things, I don't see the chances, especially in this city, of a third party or second party candidate winning. And for me personally, I don't think that we have time to wait for that to work out. I have kids, you know, climate is changing rapidly. And one of the reasons that I was most attracted to Bernie Sanders was that he was the only one at the time really shining a light on climate change. And how I really gained traction in organizing was with Mothers Out Front, because I'm so worried about the future that my children have. So I see my party change is really strategic. And, you know, to be a little critical, you know, we don't really have a platform, you know, nationally and even locally. We're developing
Democrats.
We're developing one locally. But what does it really mean to be a Democrat? You know, I haven't changed any since I switched parties. My values are still the same. My priorities are still the same. I'm just, you know, in a party that is made up of people. And to change the party, you change the people who are inside of it. So, you know, back, you know, when we were with Bernie, it was kind of the Dem enter strategy. You know, I feel committed to making change happen. And the party that I'm running on doesn't change that.
Okay. Do you think of yourself as a Green still?
I don't know. Like I said, you know, the party doesn't, you know, I'm a Democrat and it just doesn't weigh that much on my mind. I think I like to think of myself as a sparky outsider, you know, but I'm a progressive Democrat.
A progressive Democrat, and the party label matters a little less to you, it sounds like. Okay.
And if I'm a registered Green, but it's not like it's my favorite team and I'll go down with the ship. If the party were ever to change its platform or go in a direction that I don't agree with, I would no longer be registered as a Green. I'm more on the issues.
Well, then let's hit one of the issues that Mary just brought up here. Dave, Mary is critical of her own party for not having a more sort of firm and out front platform regarding climate. Do you think that's fair criticism of Democrats? And do Greens have a platform for what you'd want to do locally?
I can't speak to. Okay, so there was a lot in there.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
So the Greens definitely have one nationally. I don't think the Dems are going to come up with anything that's really concrete and that's really going to be what we need because of the special interests that keep contributing to that party. Locally, the party I don't think has one. I know I do as a candidate.
Okay, so as a candidate, what do you take into office if you're elected to city council regarding climate?
Okay, so there's a lot of things, and actually most of these issues are intersectional. So it's not, we do have a climate action plan, but I don't think the word action should be in it. It's very good at examining what the problem is and what could happen if we don't do stuff, but the actual doing is a lot more studying and committees and things like that. There's not a lot of actual action in this plan. So a lot of the stuff that I'm calling for, that I'm going to be working for when I get into office, is actual action. So what I'd like to do is see part of my economic development in terms of cooperative businesses is going to be keyed on things that are more making our environment more sustainable. So, for example, really can get into the weeds with this, but changing zoning so that we can have more agriculture in the city and doing it in organic ways, which will also affect climate, help climate change. I'd like to see orchards within the city that actually grows food, which helps with our food problem in the city, but also affects climate change. I would like to see zoning change the way we do building, use the building materials that we use so that that'll affect climate change too. So I'm actually taking a stance where we're doing other things that help us in other ways while making sure it has a positive effect on climate change.
Where do you want the orchards to be?
We've got a lot of open land.
Yeah.
We really do. I know we like talking about the empty space that's over around Remington Street. It's where I grew up in 14621, so I just have that in my head. But there's a lot of open space, and there'll need to be some soil remediation, but I have some stuff on my platform about that as well. I don't think soil remediation should just be scooping it up in a big truck and taking it out somewhere. There's other ways we can do that.
Okay. On the climate platform, what would you come into office with Mary Lou being?
Well, when talk about intersectionality, it's absolutely true. And one of the areas it's really important to address is in housing. You know, we have really old housing stock in Rochester that wasn't very well insulated. And it's really hard for a single mother who's renting, and now the rent is becoming unaffordable, and she's paying almost the same amount of rent in heat. You know, so we really need more money and more resources to take advantage of the existing programs that are out there to help insulate a lot of these homes. And some of the problem there is, working between landlords and tenants. So we really have to do a better job with that. But it's hitting, one of our biggest climate carbon emitters is household energy. And it's also, hitting the pockets of people who really need to be to have more money in their pockets to be able to climb out of poverty.
Okay. And I think sometimes when listeners aren't familiar with older houses or houses that have been updated with insulation, it can be remarkable the bills that come just in terms of energy.
My next door neighbor, she paid $650 in rent and $500 in heat. And for half of a house, and I pay $600 in my mortgage. So for half of a house, she was paying double what I was paying. And of course, in my area of the city, landlords aren't taking care of their properties, and she was living with raw sewage in the basement. So it's just, it's a justice issue and it's a climate issue.
But be specific here. What can council help enact? What can the city do? What mechanisms are in place to start changing that?
Well, if we had a program for helping insulate old houses, we have money in the city, and where we spend it determines our priorities. We are, like Dave says, we're giving millions of dollars away to people who don't need it. We're focusing investment on areas of the city that don't need it. In our 2034 plan, they're focusing in housing dollars in what they call middle market neighborhoods, which are neighborhoods that are already taking off. And we're actually trying to put the brakes on the displacement due to gentrification. And instead, we could focus that money on, areas of the city that aren't getting any housing investment. There's no, coffee shops popping up on the corner. And it's really a justice issue to be focusing our money on those historically disinvested areas, which are mostly areas of color.
Well, let's ask both of you about this. And I promise, they've just dipped their toe in on climate. We'll come back to that because I know it animates both of them. But on the subject of these sort of taking off neighborhoods that in some ways you're worried about displacement, you almost want to pump the brakes. What's an example? Take me to a place in the city
My neighborhood, Beechwood.
Beechwood.
Yeah. So we, you know, 10 years ago, that was a place where, you know, nobody wanted to live. And they were, if they were there, they were there until they could figure out a way out. And in the last 10 years, things have turned around dramatically. And so we've got houses that were on the market in 2016 for $29,000, now going for $56,000 three years later. Rents, you know, the house next to me that I mentioned with the raw sewage, they did nothing to improve it. Now it's going for $800. So it's just rapidly, the prices are rising. Investors are coming in and fixing up houses, which we want, right? But we want the houses to go to people in our neighborhood instead of investors coming in and just doing the bare minimum in order to get maximum value. And the market is doing exactly what the market is designed to do in getting the most value for the investor. But there are initiatives that are already in progress that really just need advantages at the city level and investment, like the City Roots Community Land Trust, which is, you know, it's kind of a complicated model, but the basic idea is that you're taking these properties out of the market and you're putting them in trust so that the community determines what happens for them. And because of the agreement that you make with the trust, your value in resale is limited. So the investment and the subsidy you put into the property, the person would get, you know, say it's a $70,000 home on the market, the person would be sold a house for $50,000. But in return, you know, they would be able to sell it for $70,000 when they're ready to sell. So they're gaining wealth by not spending all their money on rent. They're gaining equity. And at the end of the day, they're making sure that house is permanently affordable for the next person. So it's focused on community wealth building and not just individual wealth building.
What's an example of the city giving millions of dollars to people who don't need it? People like who?
The Rochester Economic Development entity gave $750,000 to Wegmans. Does Wegmans need $750,000? No, they don't.
Okay. And one more question before I turn back to Dave here. I know you think this is a false choice, but some listeners are probably thinking, okay, you just described Beechwood, your neighborhood,
yes,
a decade ago being a place where not a whole lot of people wanted to live there.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're talking about the things that have been happening to change that, and you want to pump the brakes on it. Why do you want to go back to that? I know you think it's a false choice, but explain why it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, so it's not going backwards. It's any time that you put into improving a neighborhood, any investment that you make, it's going to affect the housing market. Because if you're making it better, the houses are worth more. So it's improving neighborhoods with a real focus on preventing displacement. And so if you just go in and make the improvements for the people that are there now, 10 years from now, those aren't going to be the same people that are benefiting from it. So it's intentionally putting, you know, Habitat, for example, the land trust is trying to work with Habitat. So every house that Habitat builds is in the community land trust. You know, the city can give vacant parcels of land to the community land trust so that they can be developed. It's really doing it with the understanding that the work that you're doing is going to cause unintended consequences.
But if I live there, mm-hmm, and I'm assuming there's going to be neighbors who live there whose homes are not involved with the community land, mm-hmm, trust, and the assessment and therefore the taxes that I pay goes up by 40%, 50%, and all of a sudden I say, well, I can pay the mortgage, mm-hmm, but taxes are, yep, getting out of control. Is there anything you can do for people in that category?
Well, we could cut their taxes. You know, we can, in strategically for homeowners that live in these areas that income qualify, we can give them a break on their taxes. We give corporations breaks on their taxes.
Okay, so you think there are mechanisms the city has still?
Absolutely.
Okay, Dave.
Okay.
So if you want to work backwards there, but did you agree with her assessment, for example, on Beechwood or other neighborhoods like it that are sort of taking off, but taking off in ways that are displacing people?
Yes. Beechwood, Plex, I am really, really nervous about what's happening in Bullshead. We're tearing down buildings. There's public money going into that area, and there's not a clear vision of what's going to be put in there. I really feel that there's going to be some kind of gentrification that will be hooked onto the U of R somehow. So, yes, and I'm going to answer your last question. Yes, there is something. And in fact, that's in my platform. If there's any kind of development that raises the assessments of houses or any buildings in that area, I say that we have a tax freeze I don't have a number of years. We can say 10 years, whatever. We can negotiate that. But an actual tax bill freeze, not a rate freeze, a bill freeze, because this happens at the county all the time, where they've been bragging for decades since Jack Doyle was in office that they never raised property taxes, but the assessments go up and the fees go up. So there needs to be a tax bill freeze.
Whatever your tax bill is, it freezes.
It freezes. If there's development that goes in there that raises the assessments level, so yeah, things that normally your tax bill will go up. Because what we're doing is we're making the assumption that if you build it, people will come. Okay, we can argue about that, but you're totally forgetting about the people who are there. And most of the people in the, like, Beechwood 10 years ago, and this is historical, Cornhill, a lot of places that we consider, Park Avenue used to be the place not to be around until investments started going up, and now where rents are, and I try to buy a house around there, how much it costs. This has been historic. So you can look at the stuff now, but this isn't anything new. So it's in my platform. I call for a tax bill freeze wherever there's development that raises assessment rates.
Okay. And what about home ownership? The city has recently talked, Dave, about choice and expanding options for people who are going to build and own in the city of Rochester. Do you support what the city is doing there?
Are you referring to the ability for multifamily? Is that what you're talking about?
Choice is I think it's called Choice is the name of the program.
Oh, okay.
It's been
a few
weeks here. Yeah, and
my focus has been on that with the 2034 plan, so I'm sorry.
It's been around for more than a decade. It's only actually been used about 50-plus times, but the city wants to take it not just downtown, in the downtown
proper
place, to all city neighborhoods.
Yeah, I still think that that's making an assumption that it's going to drive people. I don't think that's what's going to attract people into the city from either other places. And the argument's been made that we're going to be getting climate change refugees, which is a topic we can talk in down the road. But I don't think the refugees we're going to get are not going to be coming in to buy houses. They're going to be the folks like we get up coming from Puerto Rico like we had in the last 2 years.
Okay.
So I don't think it's going to work for folks like that. If you're coming in, I would rather see people who are renting right now in the city to give them first refusal in terms of buying a house. I would like to see the houses that we have that aren't occupied right now to be given to people very cheaply and have some kind of – and there's a number of ways to go about this, so I'm open for discussion on exactly how we – have people get a hold of these properties. I mean, community land trust is good, and it's a good model, and I like where they're going, but there's other ways of doing this as well. And because the studies keep showing, because my focus in this in terms of home ownership is people who are actually, I would rather work from the bottom, homeless, and move up. I think that would make Rochester a better place to live. I think taking care of that will actually attract people to come into our city, because that would be one problem that folks don't want to move into. And I would rather focus on the bottom up than trying to get people who are in the middle and relatively making it to figure out a way to get them a home.
Okay. How do you feel about the Choice program, the expansion there, Mary?
I'm not really for the Choice program in the way that they presented it as being focused on middle and high market areas. Yeah. Those are areas, like I said, you know, we're already trying to pump the brakes on development because we don't have a displacement strategy in place. If this program was focused on building houses in neighborhoods that have been historically disinvested, I'd be all for it. That's not the reality. And really, the cost of construction prohibits building new in those areas, unless you're doing it with Habitat for Humanity or Urban League, because of the high cost of construction and the house value wouldn't really cover it. But, you know, if we're going to use this program to give Habitat homeowners a break on their taxes, you know, you pay nothing the first year, mm-hmm. and each year increases by 10%. I think that would be a great strategy to helping people get into homeownership.
I talked to a developer in Rochester a few weeks ago after one of the programs we had about development in the city, and he said at some point along the line, the word developer became a pejorative for some people. Is it for you, Mary Lupien, when you hear developer?
It's certainly been associated with people who are putting profit over people. I don't necessarily agree that they're all developers are bad. I've met quite a few developers who are doing this for the right reasons. There's just so much money to be made in real estate right now, and we can even look to our president and to see how the wealthy 1% has used real estate to really suck public money out of our government.
Do you think developers have driven the political conversation in Rochester? Do you think the money has talked? Or at least the policy and the land use?
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a direct relationship with campaign contributions and the policy that comes out. And, you know, it may not be corruption, but it's just when you have friends, you get into a certain world where that makes sense. And, it's... I think this about the system. You know, so many politicians go in this with the right mindset, but the system is corrupt, and the system corrupts you if you're not careful. And so, when you're in it long enough, certain things start to feel normal that really aren't. So, I think in that context, yes, absolutely.
Okay, Dave.
Well, I'll start with the first thing you asked. If I think it's a pejorative, yeah, I do think it is. I'm not saying I'm declaring it one, but you asked me if that word has become. Has had a negative connotation these days in Rochester. Yes, and I think for the reasons we've been talking about. And that's okay. And here's the thing. I would like to see if it continues to be that way, maybe the developers will go, you know what, maybe I don't need these tax breaks. Maybe that actually our city would be better off if that money went to the libraries and the fire department and if we fully funded our schools the way we're legally supposed to do. So maybe they would see it in their best interest in our long-term future if they didn't go looking for those. Because there's been times when, you know, they really, most of the time, were really they could have built certain projects when they didn't need the money, but they were able to get them. And our politicians seem to be willing to give those breaks at will. And you know what? If you get campaign contributions from a Glazer or a Hanna or something like that, there's going to be times where you got to vote on something that they're building, and there's going to be a certain expectation, even if there's not. I know this is, everybody likes to talk, this is in fashion now, even if there's not a quid pro quo. But if you get money from those folks, then there's going to be some expectations. The very least, you're going to have more than the average access than a regular voter would.
Okay. Do you want to add to that?
Just as an example, look at the Xerox Tower. That project's going to be $36 million, and they're going to get $3 million from the state. Do they really need that $3 million? If they're already investing $36, is that $3 million going to make or break the project? But the money's available, so why wouldn't they apply for it? But these projects, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago, we needed that kind of incentive to build in the city, but we don't anymore. You know, the market is going to take care of itself. And we need to stop using our public money to really just soften the deal for these developers.
And it's why I won't take money from a developer. No, I don't know if they're going to come and offer to a green, but maybe they already know that. But I wouldn't accept it anyway.
Dave Sutliff-Adius is the Green Party candidate for Rochester City Council in the East District, and Mary Lupien is the Democrat running for Rochester City Council in that district on the ballot next month. After our only break of the hour, we are going to take some of your phone calls for the candidates, and we've got a lot more of the issues to work through, including police accountability, climate change, and more, with Mary Lupien and Dave Sutliff-Adius on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the very latest when it comes to the recommendations, the guidelines for who needs screenings for breast care, who needs a mammogram, and when. When should you start? What are the risk factors, and what do we know about them? If it seems like those guidelines have changed over the years, we're going to try to sort it all out for you next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To your phone calls we go. In Rochester, this is Fred. Go ahead, Fred.
Well, they brought up the question of climate change, and I wonder what their positions are on the fact that our food source is our biggest contributor to climate change.
Our food source? You're talking about animal agriculture?
Yes.
Okay. Are you asking them specifically if they eat meat or if they want the city to do something about animal agriculture?
No, if they have a plan to add that to, since it's accounts for, I've heard numbers between 41 and 50-some percent of our gases that cause climate change. What can they do to help that?
Fred, thank you. And, you know, various studies will give you various answers, but for the most part, you can assume that, or you can pretty feel safe saying that animal agriculture and fossil fuel burning are roughly similar in terms of global impact on climate. So, Dave, I'll start with you here. Okay. How do you see that issue here from the question from Fred there.
Well, let's put it this way. In terms of food production, and I kind of started talking about this earlier in the hour, I would like to see more of our food grown locally. I know that sounds trendy and hip, but I do look at this from a social justice aspect, but which is also connected to climate change, because climate change is a social justice aspect as well. So I would like to see the changes in our zoning laws so that we can do more agriculture in the city, commercial agriculture, although not big business, and then use this tax money that we're going to be saving from not doing corporate welfare anymore to help start cooperative farms within the city. And then businesses would sprout off of that that would be using this food that is grown, including supermarkets cooperatively owned in the city, restaurants cooperatively owned in the city, in the neighborhoods that need them, that are depressed right now. And that would also have an effect on food production and climate change at the same time.
Okay. Mary Lupien?
Yeah, we are actually really lucky in Rochester to have a really active urban ag scene. We have Taproot Collective and the Urban Agricultural Working Group that have been working for years to push our government to create a food policy council. And I think that would go a long way to figuring out how we can really use our vacant land to have urban agriculture and, you know, farms in our city. And, you know, with the vacant lots and having, you know, small community gardens, we can also really focus on in our institutions, in, you know, the school district isn't necessarily part, it is not run at this time by the city, that may change. But, you know, the food that we serve and making sure that, you know, we have vegan components when possible, and any of our events that we're serving vegan food, you know, food is such a huge issue for me, especially when we're talking about the schools. Just, you know, we're the institution where we're supposed to be setting the example, and we feed them crap. And so it's also a justice issue with, you know, not feeding our kids sugar and salt, and just it sets them up for all kinds of illnesses as they get older. And a big contributor to the lower life expectancy for people who are in poverty. So I think having local sources of food and trying to infuse vegan menus into where we can are some great ways to start.
When it comes to the broader strokes of climate change, is transportation part of it for both of you? I'll start with you, Mary. And what are your thoughts on what city council, what you could do in office, and what the city of Rochester could do differently in regards to transportation?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the RTS, you know, city council gets one appointment to the council. So there's some leverage there. However, you know, each county also gets an appointment, and there's historically been struggle in servicing, you know, the city versus the county. But there's so much more to do outside of that. There, you know, we could incentivize employers to have, you know, benefits for employees that take public transportation or rides their bikes to work. We can build more infrastructure for bikes. We have a good start, but it's nowhere near where it needs to be. And, you know, thinking about things like light rail in the future and the van pooling program, there's a lot of things that we can do that are a little bit outside the box in the mainstream and just the public transit system. But, you know, we need more density downtown. And that's definitely something that the city, not just downtown, but in our neighborhoods as well, to be able to have the required ridership that we need to support public transport.
Now, you bring up light rail, not to make it overly political, but generally speaking, when we see advocacy for light rail, it comes from the political left in this country, the political right, mm-hmm. generally very opposed to it. We see California, again, not a city, an entire state, that recently paused some of their planning. And the governor out there says this is not an elimination of plans for multimodal future, but the political right making hay of that, saying, look, you can't afford it. Costs are always too high. It's not going to happen. Do you see anything that says to us here in Rochester, we can't afford it, it does make sense, we need to pursue it?
It's just the way you look at it. You know, which costs are you looking at? You know, because historically, when you put in a light rail line, the development around it skyrockets in value. And if, you know, and cities have actually been proactive about purchasing land around planned routes in order to recapture some of that money. So it just depends on how you go about it. You know, light rail is expensive, but I think that we can make it work here.
Okay. Dave, transportation, how you see that as a climate issue and justice and access?
Well, okay. So the justice and access part, this is a heavy lift. And I know there'll be, if there's anybody from RGRTA that's listening right now, they may do a spit take or something like that. But we would have to work with the state. I would like to basically tear down RGRTA and start over again. I think the way that they do business, and I'm saying this from personal experience as in a previous job when I was working with the Center for Disability Rights, I did have to interact with the organization, with they're an authority, state authority. I've had to interact with them quite a bit, and I just don't see it as a model that's working. I don't think that they're able to change in the way we need to be able to deal with social justice aspects of this in terms of access to public transportation, and as well as the climate part of it, in terms of people aren't using public transportation, and I'm going to include bikes in that, enough, and they're not going to, because we have a car-centered culture, and it's going to stay that way as long as our public transportation works the way it does. It's not going to change.
What are the dominoes that you'd have to knock down if you get an office as one member of Rochester City Council?
Oh, well, obviously I couldn't do it on my own. I'm just giving you
sure,
the idea of how this is going to happen, and I would totally be willing to go to Albany and advocate for this if I had other people with me doing this. This isn't going to be a one-person band making this happen. But we don't have enough representation in the city as how RGRTA functions. We don't. And people with disabilities don't either. There's always some tokenism there, but nothing really happens. And we keep, every time somebody calls for a change to RGRTA, the response you get back is, okay, well, what services are we going to take away to pay for that? And that's all we keep. So something's always got to get taken away. So I keep saying this, and I'm not saying there's enough to pay for all of this all in one shot, but there is money to be able to do the things that we want to do, whether it's light rail, doing it a little bit at a time, or changing the bus system the way we do it in terms of the hub and spoke system to doing something else so that people don't have to. It shouldn't take an hour to get across a small city like this.
Mary, do you think the city of Rochester, at least this administration, is serious about really advocating for bicycle infrastructure and other infrastructure that doesn't favor the automobile?
I think they've been really good, actually, about implementing bike infrastructure. I think it's taking longer than I would like it to, but they have a plan. And, you know, Eric Frisch was in charge of that, and I trust him, you know, very much with his intentions. He's moved out of that department now, but, you know, I really do think that it's a priority. However, you know, I think it's more having to do with what it means for development. You know, it's clear the link between, you know, people wanting to live downtown and being able to use other modes of transportation. And so, you know, I don't know if it was climate focused necessarily, but, you know, I think they are serious about bike infrastructure. Other modes of getting off of our car-centric society, I'm not so sure. You know, building more parking garages downtown, you know, and I get that we're not there yet, but in other areas, they've built parking garages in ways that they can be easily converted into apartments or retail down the line. And I don't know if we're really thinking that far ahead to a future where we're not a car-centric city.
So if we are building any parking, we better be planning for a future in which we can convert that space.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think this city administration is serious about both bike infrastructure and then other modes of transportation?
Yeah, they are. But the city hall has a way of doing things where they already know what they want to do, and they get public input. I put air quotes on around input. And generally, I know, and you can say, hey, we changed a little bit here on the margins, on the edges and stuff. But generally, what they want to do is what's going to happen. But I'll be honest with you, in this case, it's the people that live here. We're not willing as a group. We're not really ready to give up our car culture here. And you know, you look around and the way the weather's changing and the things that are happening, we're going to have to, whether we want to or not, at some point. So we might as well do it up front. And that would be difficult for me personally as well. But I do think, just because I've seen like the development, the changes that are coming to East Main Street, that corridor between Goodman and Culver, there are folks who live there, who have lived there for decades, who are really nervous and upset about the potential plans. There's two choices, and both of them include bike lanes and a loss of parking spaces on the street. And that's going to upset their lives. And that's legit and that's real. But by the same token, we need to start creating that more infrastructure, because we do have some for biking. And that's a conflict there. And I would love to tell you I have the solution to that, but I don't yet. And I've been working on it because I've been talking to people in that neighborhood and they've expressed that to me. And I'm still doing research on my own. I don't have that magic idea that what's going to satisfy everybody on this. But it's got to come.
I want to move to police accountability. As we do that, yeah. Mary mentioned briefly Eric Frisch, who has been in doing transportation work and really great work for a long time for the city of Rochester. Where is he at now? Is he still within the city?
Is it special projects?
I ask because Eric has not been allowed to come on this program since the mayor put a stop of anybody in the administration coming on this program. So I haven't seen Eric in a while. But Eric, if you're listening, would love to chat sometime soon to kind of catch up on the work you're doing. There are people like Eric Frisch who have a tremendous vision for what this city can still look like and when it comes to multimodal transportation, and some really great people working for the city. So as we talk police accountability, I know it's an animating issue for both of you. Yeah. Mary Lupien, where are we with the PAB? And where do we need to go? Tell me what you want to do when you become a member of city council if you win.
Okay. So where we are right now is that the Locust Club has submitted a lawsuit which has resulted in an injunction on the referendum on the ballot. It's actually still going to be there when you vote between October 26th and November 5th. But it may or may not count, which, you know, I think is terrible, because, you know, it's giving people false hope that if it doesn't count, you know, that we've put all this work into it and it's finally gone on the ballot, only to kind of anticlimactically not count. However, I believe it's the 17th. We're awaiting a response on an appeal. So should it get on the ballot and, you know, the however many years after that, the Locust Club ties it up in court, you know, I think it's really important, because all of the members of the Police Accountability Board will be voted on by City Council. City Council will put forth four candidates to be selected. And I believe that the way that it was presented is that one person from each district council people will put forth those nominations. And so I would be one of them. And so I would work very closely with the Police Accountability Board Alliance to identify that person that I would be putting forward as nomination. And obviously I would vote in the way that they had envisioned.
Best case, worst case scenario going forward here is what? What's the best case?
We win the appeal. It's on the ballot. It counts. We win. The Locust Club does not challenge it. And we get a police accountability board that is filled with people who are impartial and really dedicated to making sure that justice is served and has an understanding of the historic racism and bias on our police force and really works to correct it.
And that could start as soon as when, if all of those things happen?
If there's no lawsuit, you know, as soon as the referendum is voted on, that it can go into effect. Yeah. They have to hire an executive director. And so the current system will continue until they do that.
But we could be months away.
Oh, yeah.
We could be months away. Worst case scenario is what?
That it doesn't count on the ballot and the community loses faith in our efforts. But I don't see that as happening. I really don't. There's just so much. It's needed. And everyone that I talk to in the community knows that it's needed. You know, whether it's on Parcells Avenue or Park Avenue, when I was going door to door in the campaign, nearly everyone I talked to said how important police accountability was for this community. We get it. We're ready.
But when the Locust Club raises their concerns, I mean, have you talked directly to any of the members, the leaders there?
I have. I've sat down with Mazzio before, and I get where they're coming from a union perspective. You know, the rank and file officers are going to be the ones that are held accountable. However, the management is not. The management is not part of this legislation. So from that perspective, yeah, if the management is setting a certain priority and the rank and file officers are the one who have to carry it out, I get that that's not fair. But you know, it's not a reason to not enact the legislation. It's certainly something that can be improved. But at the end of the day, individual police officers are responsible for their own behavior.
Okay. And if Mike Mazzio is listening now, or I'm sure we can have another conversation soon and in the future, but beyond that notion of management versus rank and file and sort of who's held liable, there's also, I think, a concern that officers have expressed that certain events will be viewed out of context. You know, certain videos don't always capture the whole story. Police feel like there are times where there is an out-of-context interpretation of events, and they want to be given a fair look at all of this. And I know that's some of what Mike has expressed.
Yeah.
And so what's the message, whether it's Mike Mazzeo or other officers who are worried?
So the people on the Police Accountability Board are going to be heavily trained on RPD policies and procedures. They have the chief and a liaison as serving as an advisor. You know, any decision they have any kind of questions about, they will come to them for their opinion. It's just they're not a voting member of the body. And the board can have up to one member who has background in criminal justice but is not a current or former RPD officer.
Okay.
So, you know, there's real intention around creating that awareness of what police officers have to go through. But, you know, and I'll say too, the Locust Club has also shown some things and misrepresented some situations that have happened to their benefit to say, oh, look, the Police Accountability Board is causing our officers to be put in danger. There was an episode where a police officer was hit in the head with a rock by a seventh grader. And they said it's because of the Police Accountability Board. But that seventh grader happened to be in my school, and I knew the real situation, and it was a mistake. He was actually aiming for the rival gang member who they got into a fight earlier in that day. So, you know, and he had a 45-minute press conference about that. And so I really take issue with the Locust Club spreading misinformation about this, what this is doing to our community. There are people, there are kids. Just the other day in my school, you know, somebody asked an eighth grader, are you going to be a soldier someday? I don't really know the context, but he said, no, miss, soldiers are police, and I would never be a police officer. Yeah. This kids are young by the time that they know that they're viewed unfairly and that they're seen as criminals. And the unrest that exists is not because of the Police Accountability Board. It's been there, and it's bubbling over.
Let me have Dave.
Yeah, I'm here.
The floor is yours.
Okay. I haven't been given much room now, but as a member of the Police Accountability Board Alliance, almost since it started, I've been working on this. And yeah, I understand the language, and the referendum will be on there. I've been in my door to door, which I will continue to do up until November 5th. I will be pushing for that and inviting people to vote yes on that. And we'll let the courts play out however it works, whether it's binding or not. All we can do is tell the people in charge that this is what we want, the way the legislation is. And actually, I don't even think the legislation goes far enough. There should be a little bit. It should be a little bit stronger.
Tell me about that. How can you make it stronger?
Well, I think basically what's going to happen is all of the members of the PAB, once this gets going, they all have to be approved by city council. So even the mayor's one person, the four city council appointed people, and the Police Accountability Board Alliance's four members, they all still have to be approved by city council. So if the PABA nominates you, Evan, and the city council says, yeah, no, go back and get another one. So they get to just keep saying no to people until they get somebody who they want. I think there's a weakness there because that could lead to political appointments. That could cause some trouble down the line. But of course, there's always ways to adjust as we go. But we need to have this going so that we can make those adjustments once we see what works and what doesn't.
Dave, here's another concern that people like Mike Mazzeo have raised, which is that if you have an accountability system that officers perceive as being heavy-handed, they may be hesitant to act in a way that they've been trained to act, putting themselves in jeopardy in the field. In other words, if they would normally act in a certain way, but they're worried that it would be viewed as too forceful or misunderstood, that they may not do that. And if they make those kinds of decisions, they could be at risk.
If a police officer is behaving the way they're supposed to be, just like we're told, if you don't do anything wrong, you shouldn't have to have anything to worry about.
So you don't buy that concern?
No, I don't. And if there's an officer who acts that way, they probably have chosen the wrong profession, to be honest with you. And as just explained, there's going to be not only the police chief, but there will be people, liaisons, to explain to the Police Accountability Board police procedure. And a very good thing about this is that the PAB can also recommend changes in police procedure. They can't mandate it, but they can recommend changes in police procedure to avoid issues like this as well. So that's another part of this that really will help make our city safer.
30 seconds. Anything you disagree there?
I just want to comment. You know, this all comes down to fear. You know, police officers are trained to accurately predict what their instincts are telling them. The problem is that their instincts are telling them that Black people are dangerous. And that's really what we have to fight here. And so, you know, mandatory implicit bias training, 100%. But we really have to go deeper into fighting the fear that's put into people because of the society that they were raised in. And there are many officers that may not think that they're racist, but they hold racist beliefs because of this culture that they were raised in. And that's what we have to work on, you know, whether it's a questionnaire or the implicit bias training.
All right. Final word then from you. Do you agree? Are you concerned with racism in the department?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And that's not just at RPD. That's the structure, the nature of policing. I mean, they started as slave catchers. I mean, if you know the history, that's how police departments in the U.S. started. And just by historically their nature, yeah.
Can training help?
Help, yes.
Help.
Help. Okay. I think how we deal with what we perceive as crimes need to be dealt with in a different way. In a more humanistic way.
Where can people find more about you online, Dave?
DaveForChange.org, my website, all my social media handles.
Dave Sutliff-Adius is the Green Party candidate for Rochester City Council in the East District. The Democrat is Mary Lupien. Where can people find more online?
MaryLupien.com and on all social media, MaryLupienRock, R-O-C.
Thank you both for being here, sharing the hour with us. Election Day is on November 5th, coming up in 25 days. More Connections coming up.